2 Samuel chapter 23. Now these are the last words of David. Thus says David the son of Jesse. Thus says the man raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel. The Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me. He who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God, and he shall be like the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, like the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain. Although my house is not so with God, yet he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. For this is all my salvation and all my desire. Will he not make it increase? So look at that, those first five verses, and we see there David's swan song. The swan song is the phrase which really means his last song. It may not have been, but we can take it as such that it was his swan song. And we find here he is describing the just one. He says in verse 2, the Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. And from this we gain the knowledge that when men of God spoke, they were not speaking their own words. We have to hold on to that. We have to hold on to the fact that when Paul speaks or when David speaks, even in passages which give us problems, we must say it is first of all God speaking through them. They are merely the spokesman for God, and therefore we cannot say that these are the words of men. Once we begin to view these words as the words of men, we get into a lot of trouble. We are going against the whole teaching that Scripture is God-breathed, breathed by God. The Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. And then we have his confession. He mentions here that he himself doesn't fit that description in verse 5. After describing this ideal ruler, he says, my house is not so with God, but although my house is not so with God, yet he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. For this is all my salvation and all my desire. Will he not make it increase? So we see here his description of one who is a godly king. And he's really describing the messianic king here. He says, he who rules over men must be just. Do you notice in verse 3, the God of Israel is also called the Rock of Israel. We have a description here of this righteous messianic ruler. He is to be just. He is to be ruling in the fear of God. He will be like the light of the morning. He will be like the sunrise. He will be like a morning without clouds. He will be like tender grass. And his coming will be like clear shining after rain. We all know that when we've had a rainfall and then the sun bursts out through the clouds. David's confession in verse 5, that's not true of me and it's not true of my family. But his confidence was in not in himself or in his family, but in God's faithfulness and in God's promise. In verse 5, he says, although my house is not so with God, yet he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and sure. And by that he means that God has made a covenant with him, and in that covenant is included the promise of this very person. Remember, the covenant God made with David was that his kingdom would endure forever, that it would last forever. And David is saying here, this is my hope, this is my salvation, and this is all my desire. This one that God is going to provide because of his covenant with me is going to be my salvation. He is going to be my savior as well. And he says this will happen because of the faithfulness of God. Look at the titles of the Messiah as borne out by the prophets. David said in verse 3, the righteous ruler must be just. And when we look at Zechariah chapter 9 and verse 9, we see those famous words, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, behold, thy king cometh unto thee, he is just and having salvation." There is the one that David spoke about that now God is announcing through the prophet Zechariah. He was also to rule in the fear of God. And when we look at Isaiah chapter 11, we find that this one who is called there the son of Jesse, who is really the father of David, he is going to rule in the fear of God. Isaiah 11 verses 1 and 2, "There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots." That title, branch, is a messianic title. "The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord." That's exactly what God's specifications are here in 2 Samuel 23. "He who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." So David is saying, this is the one that I have placed my desire upon. This is the one who is all my salvation. Furthermore, God says in verse 4 of 2 Samuel 23, "He shall be like the light of the morning when the sun rises." Remember Balaam. He said, "There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall arise out of Israel." Someone who is a light bringer, who will arise out of the nation. And when we look at Hosea chapter 6, we find there the prophet exhorting his people to return to the Lord. And he says, if we return to the Lord, then he will heal us. And furthermore, he's going to send us new life. "Come and let us return to the Lord, for he has torn, but he will heal us. He has stricken, but he will bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up, that we may live in his sight. Let us know, let us pursue the knowledge of the Lord. His going forth is established as the morning. He will come to us like the rain, like the latter and former rain to the earth." The latter rain was the spring rain. The former rain was in the fall. He says he's come like the spring rain and like the fall, the rain that comes in the fall. The spring rain is usually light rain. The fall rain comes down in torrents. So there's a promise here of initial blessings followed by torrents of blessing. David is speaking about him like that. He speaks of him like sunrise. Malachi the prophet in chapter 4 and verse 2, he says, "To you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings." All these are messianic prophecies that bear out what God spoke through David. We find that the prophets are bearing witness to what he said. "A morning without clouds. The people that sat in darkness have seen a great light." In Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 2. "Like tender grass," we read about him, "he shall grow up like a shoot out of dry ground. Like a tender, he shall grow up before God as a tender plant." God calls him a tender plant in Ezekiel 17. He talks of him as the topmost shoot of the cedar tree, which represents the family of David. The topmost shoot, the tender plant, clear, shining after rain. We saw that in Hosea chapter 6. So David is speaking here about this great Messiah that is to come. And he's rejoicing that although he has failed in God's covenant with David and with David's family, God had already provided one who would not fail. And that David is rejoicing in that. But look what he says about the fate of the wicked. He speaks about the wicked, and the wicked are not people necessarily who are outrageous in their behavior. Many of them are, but not all. There are people who are wicked in the sight of God, who in the sight of men are pure and upright. The Lord Yeshua spoke to the Pharisees, and he said, God knows your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. So we can be very pure and upright. What was the fault of those Pharisees? Well, they depended on themselves and on their efforts to get to heaven. They depended on their own system of good deeds in order to save them. And in doing so, they spurned God's promise of one that would save the sinner. Because the Bible, as Lionel read this morning, all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. Isaiah 64. This is what he says about the wicked. The sons of rebellion shall be as thorns thrust away, because they cannot be taken with hands. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and the shaft of a spear, and they shall be utterly burned with fire in their place. That is the fate of the wicked. That whole picture of burning with fire we find mentioned all over the Bible. Then, after David's song, we have the catalogue of his mighty men. His three greatest warriors are mentioned first of all. Verse 8. These are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Yosheb Bashevet means literally in Hebrew, the one who sits in the seat. That probably meant he sat at the head of the company. They probably had their meals, their times when they had meals together. He sat at the head of the table. Yosheb Bashevet, the Tachmonite. Chief among the captains, he was called Adino the Eznite, because he had killed 800 men at one time. In battle, he had managed to vanquish 800 of his foes. And after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo the Ahohite. Dodo in Hebrew means his uncle. Dod is uncle. Dodi is my uncle. Dodo means his uncle. The son of his uncle, the Ahohite. That's maybe what it means. It's hard to tell sometimes whether these names are real names or just descriptions, like Yoshevet Bashevet, we had in verse 8. One of the three mighty men with David, when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there for battle, and the men of Israel had retreated, he stood in the gap. We read in verse 10, he arose and attacked the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to his sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to plunder. So here is one that God used. And the third one, and after him, was Shammah the son of Agi the Hararite. The Philistines had gathered together into a troop, where there was a piece of ground full of lentils. Then the people fled from the Philistines, but he stationed himself in the middle of the field, defended it, and killed the Philistines, and the Lord brought about a great victory. These are the three greatest warriors that David had. The three most outstanding of his soldiers. And we read the Lord brought about a great victory. We read about it in verse 10 and verse 12. Well, says the human reader, I see here these people doing it. Remember, after the Six-Day War, 1967, lots of people in Israel were saying, this is a miracle from God. In 6 days, we have pushed back the Egyptian army, the Jordanian army, the Syrian army, and the Lebanese. And we've pushed back all the troops that were sent to help these countries to vanquish us. We've pushed them back. Pushed back the Egyptians across the Suez Canal. We pushed the Syrians back beyond the Golan Heights. We pushed the Jordanians east of the River Jordan. It must be a miracle from God. So someone asked Moshe Dayan, who was then the chief of staff, do you believe what people say that God was helping you in this war? You know what his reply was? Well, I wouldn't say it was God helping us. Rather, I would say it was us helping God. And that explains partly in any way, the terrible disaster that came upon us in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War. God doesn't let us get away with that kind of talk. Yes, indeed, the people of Israel fought just like these great heroes fought here. But the real source of our victory is not our arm. David says, some trust in horses, some trust in chariots, but we will trust in the name of the Lord our God. And so it is in our spiritual fights, in our spiritual struggles. The Lord doesn't carry us to heaven on a flowery bed of ease. He expects us to struggle. Last week we were at the conference, Yeshua Northwest, and one question I had to field was this question. Why does it say in the Bible, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling? Does that mean then we can save ourselves? So I said to them, when you come across a verse that puzzles you, look a little forwards, look a little backwards, take in the surrounding verses. And we find this, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling because it is God who's working in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. So we can do it because God is doing it. He is the great initiator. He is the source of all our victory. He is the source of all our success. If we manage to do anything, we must say, not I, but the grace of God that was with me. That's how Shaul put it. So there's the true source of their victory. Then in verse 13 to 17, we have some more of his warriors who went to Bethlehem, to the well there. Verse 13, then 3 of the 30 chief men went down at harvest time and came to David at the cave of Adullam. And the troop of Philistines encamped in the valley of Rephaim. So Adullam is to the south of Jerusalem. Then the valley of Rephaim is just to the west of Jerusalem. And further south of Adullam is Bethlehem. David was then in the stronghold and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. So they had a troop in the valley of Rephaim, but the garrison itself was in Bethlehem. That's where David was born. And he was probably feeling hot and thirsty and he thought of the cool waters of the well he had drunk so many times when he was growing up in Bethlehem. And he wished he could just have another drink from that well. Verse 15, and David said with longing, oh, that someone would give me a drink of the water from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. So the 3 mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water from the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. They loved their master, their leader, so much they risked their lives just to bring him a nice cool drink at the risk of their lives. Of course David wouldn't drink it. He offered it up to God and he said, this represents the blood of these men. They didn't escape unscathed. They're wounded, they're bleeding from the blows they received. the sword thrusts, how can I drink this? And he poured it out. He said in verse 17, far be it from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Is this not the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their lives? Therefore he would not drink it. These things were done by the three mighty men. These men of exploits. From verse 18 through 23, we read about some more great men. One of them was the brother of Joab, Abishai. He wasn't quite as bad as his brother. He was a rough diamond. You could call him a rough diamond. We read in verse 18, he lifted his spear against 300 men and killed them, and won a name among these three. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, in verse 20, we find he also did very dangerous and heroic exploits. He had killed two lion-like heroes of Moab. He also went down and killed a lion in the midst of a pit on a snowy day. And he killed an Egyptian, a spectacular man. The Egyptian had a spear in his hand, so he went down to him with a staff, wrested the spear out of the Egyptian's hand, and killed him with his own spear. These things did Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and won a name among three mighty men. These dangerous and heroic exploits that they did. Benaiah fancied going down into a pit. Those pits were to trap wild animals. On a snowy day, you'd have a pretty slippery conditions, wouldn't you? With the snow and the slush and a wild lion. Usually at the bottom of the pit, they had a pointed stake pointing upwards so that any animal that fell into the pit would get impaled. It looks as though that lion escaped that. It may have slipped into the pit because of the slippery conditions. Here's Benaiah jumping into this pit and at close quarters attacking this lion. We read about those heroes of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, that some of them overcame lions. Remember? Hebrews 11, verse 33. Who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. Not only Daniel, but Benaiah can be included. So could Samson. Each in their own way had conflict with a lion or with lions. And because of their faith, they came through unscathed. Then from verse 24 through 39, we have the muster of the rest of the officers. And when we look through them, we find in verse 24, Asahel, the brother of Joab. He was no longer alive, but his name was still on the roll of honor. He was the one that chased after Abner at that battle, at that first battle between David's men and the men of Saul's son. He was a very fast runner. But his fast running was no substitute for experience in hand-to-hand combat, and he lost his life at the hands of Abner. We read various other people here. I'm looking down the list. There are some who are called Hararites, verse 33. Shama the Hararite. Har means mountain in Hebrew. So it could be that Shama was a mountaineer. Who knows? Ahiam, the son of Sharar, the Hararite. Then we have some interesting names too. Verse 37. Zelek the Ammonite. Zelek, an Ammonite. In other words, David had expatriate soldiers amongst his heroes. Those that had left their idols and had vowed allegiance to him, they became amongst his most loyal soldiers. Today, Israel also has non-Jewish Israeli soldiers, especially the Druze. The Druze, they've risen up through the ranks of the army, and they are counted as some of the best soldiers that Israel has. They're not Jewish by faith or by descent, but they have become part of Israel's standing army. Here we have Zelek the Ammonite, and then we have verse 39, Uriah the Hittite. Uriah, the one that David had killed in battle. 37 in all. When we count the number of names, there are only 36. The 37th, of course, was Joab. And Joab is perhaps not mentioned here, only included by reference because the sacred penman felt Joab was not worthy of being named in this list of heroes. Joab was a good soldier, but he was no hero. He was a bloodthirsty man. Well, there we have one more, verse 34. Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. Remember Ahithophel, who he was? He was David's right-hand man. He was David's closest friend. He was David's confidant and counselor. But he was also the one that betrayed David. But we find here, the son does not repeat the sin of the father. Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, was one of David's best warriors. But there's also a sad note here. Bathsheba was the daughter of Eliam. And if indeed it is this Eliam, because I can't find any other in the name lists, the sad thing is that David seduced the daughter of one of his best fighting men. And that's one reason why God punished him so severely. Well, we find when he asked after Bathsheba, they said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam? It's probably this one. It's 50-50, because in another name list, she's called the daughter of Amiel. But that doesn't necessarily disprove the fact that Eliam was her father, because people had two or more names. Someone was asking me what my second name was. Well, Jacob. So we have second names, third names, nicknames, etc. Well, there's the list of David's mighty men, and we come now to the last chapter, chapter 24. Again, the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. The cause of David's sin was, first and foremost, the sin of Israel. The Lord, when he told them that he would let them have a king, he said, if you do wickedly, you and your king will suffer together for the wrong you do. And now it looks as though the people of Israel had provoked God to anger, and so he allowed David to sin. He allowed David to fall. It's not that he incited David. It does say here, he moved David against them. Well, when we come across a problem like that, we have to put alongside it verses like this. God neither tempts anyone, neither is tempted with evil. And when we come to the parallel passage in Chronicles, we find there, 1 Chronicles 21, Satan stood up against Israel, and Satan moved David to number Israel. So why does it say here, God moved David to number his people? The answer is because God gave Satan permission to tempt David along that line. And God always takes responsibility when he gives permission for something. The Lord didn't put it in David's heart, but just as Satan came to God about Job and he said, I want your permission to test him and to try him and to prove to you he's going to fail you, God said, all right, he's in your hand, but don't touch his life. Spare his life. This is the great mystery, that God has an action, has a part in the actions of sinful men, but not in the sin of the action. That's the biblical teaching. So David was now being lifted up with pride. Does the Lord always have to protect us from our own pride? Don't we deserve to be punished for it? And so the Lord taught David a lesson. He did so later on to one of David's descendants called Hezekiah. When Hezekiah's heart was lifted up with pride, you read, the Lord left him so that Hezekiah might know what was in his heart. Sometimes, if you're not careful, the Lord will leave us to the consequences of our own failings. He's not duty-bound to protect us. When we want to take things into our own hands, he says, all right, just like our kids. Sometimes they don't want us to hold their hands. So we say, all right, walk by yourself. Then when they fall and they scratch their knee, we say, I told you so. Well, the king said to Joab, the commander of the army, now go throughout all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and count the people, that I may know the number of the people. Joab protested. At least this time he was right. He said, why should you want to do this thing? He knew instinctively that it was the wrong thing. And we find that all the captains also were against this. Verse 4, nevertheless the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the captains of the army. All these men who had proved by risking their lives that they were true to David, and David wasn't listening to them. Wasn't it right for God to leave him to the consequences of his stubbornness? See, the Lord never lets us drop ourselves in it until we've had adequate and ample warning. When people have said to us, and God has said to us, circumstances have said to us, don't do it. And we still insist, oh, it'll be okay. The proverb says, the wise man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. So at last, he insisted, nothing they could do about it. They respected him too much to keep contradicting him. And they numbered. In 10 months they completed the census, and we find that the number of fighting men was approximately twice as much as the foot soldiers that came out of Egypt at the Exodus. And then it was suddenly in the morning, after David had slept on it, he woke up in the morning, it hit him. What have I done? Verse 10. And David's heart condemned him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done, but now I pray, O Lord, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. Now when David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer. The Lord sent him a message. Do you want to have 7 years famine? Do you want to flee 3 months before your enemies? Or would you like to have 3 days plague? That was quite a dilemma, wasn't it, for David? He was in a corner. David's reply is the reply that you and I should always say. Verse 14. Please let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man. Lord, if you're to straighten me out, please do it yourself. Please don't let people do it to me, because your mercies are very great. When I was a young believer, my pastor spoke about surrendering your life to the Lord. Giving yourself completely to him. I was scared to do it. I wondered what would happen if I did. All the calamities that would befall me. So I went to him for help. It was Derek Prince. He quoted to me this verse. Let us now fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great. Well, since then I've learned I have nothing to give to God, it's all his anyway. All I can do is to acknowledge the fact. So here was I thinking that I was holding on to something and that it was my choice whether to give it to him or still keep it for myself. I and all my breath and all I am and all I have is in God's hands. And my wisdom is to acknowledge that God is my God and that he is my keeper and to trust myself to him. After all those years since then, that was 1956, so that was quite a while ago. All these years I've been in his hands, and all these years he has looked after me, and he'll look after you. Let us now fall, please let us fall into the hand of the Lord, but especially when we do wrong, how good it is when he does the correcting himself. It's like an out-of-court settlement, isn't it? Well, the people were smitten with a pestilence. God sent a pestilence. We read verse 15, so the Lord sent a plague upon Israel from the morning till the appointed time. From Dan to Beersheba, 70,000 men of the people died. These were not innocent people. These were just some of the people that had provoked God to anger. We must not think that there is such a thing as an innocent sinner. It's a paradox. What they call an oxymoron. Innocent sinner, there's no such thing. They had sinned, they had provoked God. God chose to punish some of them, but not all of them. About 70,000 instead of 1,400,000. Well, that's about 1 in 20, I think. But then we read in verse 16, and when the angel stretched out his hand over Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the destruction and said to the angel who was destroying the people, it is enough, now restrain your hand. And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Arauna the Jebusite. The angel was hovering over Jerusalem with his sword in his hand. But we read of another angel who's called the angel of the Lord, who was by the threshing floor of Arauna the Jebusite. This angel of the Lord was God himself in the form of an angel. We come across him many times in the Hebrew Bible, in the Tanakh, the angel of the Lord. And it was probably he who said to the angel, stop, hold your hand, at that point. Then Gad came, verse 18, to David and said to him, go up, erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Arauna the Jebusite. So David, according to the word of God, went up as the Lord commanded. Arauna was from the royal line of the Jebusites, and he had a threshing floor. The threshing floor was usually on the top of a hill, on a hilltop. The ground was beaten hard. It was trodden down hard. And then on this threshing floor, they spread their grain. And then they got an ox to drag a heavy cart studded with sharp pieces of metal and stone on the underside, drive it over the corn. And as this sled went over the corn, those pieces of metal and of flint studding the underside of the sled forced the grain from the ears. Then once they had done that, the farmer picked the whole lot up with a pitchfork, threw it up into the air in the evening when the breeze was blowing. And the grain would fall straight down, the chaff would be blown to one side. So eventually you got two piles, one of chaff and one of grain. That was called the threshing floor. And God said, that's where I want you to make an altar. And that threshing floor was no other than Mount Moriah, the mountain where Abraham had offered up Isaac so many hundreds of years before. Mount Moriah. Then after that, we read that David not only bought that, but he also bought the surrounding territory. That's why we have conflicting figures between this passage here and the passage in Chronicles. We read there that David paid much more than it says here. The king bought it. Verse 24, David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. But in the account of the Chronicles, we read 600. The answer is, he first of all just bought that little plot of ground on which he could put an altar. Then when he found out that this is where God wished the future house of God to be, he bought the surrounding grounds. And that's why you have the larger figure of 600 shekels. That's where the temple stands today. Just in that Mount Moriah, which is one of the peaks of the mountain ranges of Judea. God answered David with fire from heaven. God sent fire from heaven upon David's sacrifice. And that's how David knew that instinctively and guided by the Spirit, this is the place where God's sacrifices are to be offered in the future. Verse 25, and David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord heeded the prayers for the land, and the plague was withdrawn from Israel. It ended well. The Lord was propitiated for Israel. When Arauna, the Jebusite, saw King David, and when David told him what his business was about, Arauna said to David in verse 22, let my lord the king take and offer up whatever seems good to him. Look, here are oxen for burnt sacrifice, and threshing implements, and the yokes of the oxen for wood. But the king says in verse 24, no, but I will surely buy it from you for a price, nor will I offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God with that which costs me nothing. And he was expressing a principle there that stands you and me in good stead. God doesn't want us to offer him something that is cheap. We're not to be cheap with God. When we read in the scriptures, God loves a cheerful giver. God loves the generous soul. It is because he himself is a generous soul. What we have to offer him is not perfect, but in return, he sends blessings on us that far outweigh what we could offer to him. Look at the way the sun will shine on a puddle. Nobody would drink from that puddle. The sun draws up the water and then distills it on us in pure rain. We can drink that water. It's like that with our services and our offerings. They are not unblemished. Our offerings, our services, our sacrifices have some blemish in them. But God takes them, accepts them, cleanses them, and then rains his blessings on us much better than we gave him. His shovel is bigger than ours. A farmer that I knew in Alberta, when he measured out his grain by the shovel full, always threw in an extra shovel. And his friend said to him, you'll get poor at this rate. He said, no, I won't. God's shovel is bigger than mine. And it was true. Well, there you are.